You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, while we all like to laugh, not all of us are great at making the laughs happen. We talked to a humor blogger about the rocky journey of learning to be funny.
Right now, northern Wisconsin is still recovering from torrential rainstorms last month that caused widespread damage and flooding throughout the region. Some roads were completely washed out, and homeowners in the area are wondering what to do with their properties in the future.
These rainstorms and floods were previously thought to be once-in-a-generation occurrences, but seem to be happening much more regularly.
Danielle Kading is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Superior. She's been covering the repair efforts in the region. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Chris.
So bring us up to speed as to how we got here in the first place.
Well, of course, we saw some torrential rains over the weekend of the 18th or the 17th, or the I forget the exact dates now, but middle of June, we saw a bunch of rain, up to 15 inches of rain in central Bayfield County, all in just the course of 3 days. And that really hit areas of southern and central Douglas and Bayfield counties pretty hard. It wasn't as bad as 2016 when you look at the dollar amount so far as from what we know, but we haven't gotten any final estimates yet. But it looked like it was kind of localized on those areas and, that were hit hardest, even though five counties have been included in that emergency disaster declaration area.
So you said that maybe this doesn't rise to the same financial level as the floods in 2016. We don't quite know that yet. But in terms of impact to residents, I've been seeing a lot of pictures, a lot of videos of major highways washed out. Were these floods possibly having a bigger impact on residents now than the floods from a couple of years ago?
You know, it's hard to say right now because we don't have final numbers. What I do know is that at least 120 seasonal and year-round homes in Douglas County have been affected. That's around several lakes in the county that saw their flood elevations reach about 4 feet higher than what they planned for if the area was to flood. So there have been a number of homeowners there that have seen anywhere from a couple inches to several feet of water on their main floor. And they've seen washed out driveways. And so it's just something that kind of took them by surprise. And they're trying to clean up now and see what resources might be available to them.
Yeah. What are the possible options ahead for these homeowners? I would imagine that there's a lot of cleanup and then a lot of question marks.
Yeah. It's kind of hard to say right now what assistance will be available to them. There is a community development block grant program, the emergency assistance program, where some people can look for housing assistance there. But it sounds like if they were going to get federal assistance, that there would have to be somewhere between 400 to 500 homes that would have been damaged in order to meet the threshold to get federal assistance through FEMA. So it doesn't look like, at least the Douglas County officials, they're not real confident right now that cabin and homeowners will be able to qualify for federal aid. But, you know, maybe some low-interest loans or grants might be available to them to help them recover. And hopefully some of them had flood insurance, although it's not sure how many did.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because I know you talked to one person in your reporting who said, I have flood insurance, it could be a lot worse. But, I mean, do we have a sense as to how prevalent flood insurance is in the area?
You know, it seems to be this kind of concept that only people become aware of after it happens, right? I think people are starting to become more educated about it as we're seeing more frequent and intense rain events in the area. But it's hard to say how many people actually had flood insurance. I know some people have said that they've had car insurance, and so any cars that they had damaged by the storm, they're lucky on that one. But even the guy I talked to said that the insurance that he did have wasn't going to cover the cost of him moving around from hotel to hotel until his home can be repaired, which could take several months.
And even getting to some of these homes in the first place sounded like it was difficult with major highways being washed out. Where are we at in terms of repairs to these roads?
Well, the state and federal highways, they didn't see as much damage this time around as they did a couple years ago. I mean, we saw a little bit of inconvenience on U.S. Highway 53 near Solon Springs that was reduced from 4 lanes to 2 because they had a couple of culverts there that washed out. And State Highway 35, there was a bridge washout over the Black River by Pattison State Park. The biggest washout is on U.S. Highway 2 near Ino, about 20 minutes outside of Ashland. That's going to take until August for them to repair, and they're thinking that's going to cost about $2.2 million. But that doesn't even take into account the number of town and county roads that have been washed out or damaged, and, you know, a number of them are still closed.
We're talking right now with Danielle Kading. She's a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Superior, and we are talking about recovery, repair efforts in northern Wisconsin after severe flooding in the region. And, Danny, severe weather, we're no stranger to it here in Wisconsin. We get rain, we get floods, tornadoes from time to time.
I think I prefer blizzards.
You know, I never thought I would say it, but I think I might agree with you. But this rain that we've been getting, it seems to be more and more and more. You know, maybe some of these flooding events are happening more frequently. What are you hearing from meteorologists that you've been talking to?
Yeah, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration put out this kind of official analysis of that weekend's storms in June, and it confirmed that some areas of northwestern Wisconsin saw anywhere from 100 to 1,000-year rainfall events. So basically, these are rains that are only projected to occur once in a lifetime or once in a millennia. And the Drummond area, as I said before, was very hard hit when they saw up to 15 inches of rain there over the course of several days. So, but, you know, in the last decade, we've seen, you know, July 2016, we saw 100-year flood events and 1,000-year flood events with the Bad River and how high that rose. I think it was 27 feet at the peak. And, you know, in June 2012, obviously, the Duluth Superior area was horribly hit horribly bad with a 500-year flood event. So, you know, it's just we're hearing that these things are only supposed to be happening once every 100, once every 1,000 years, but in the last several years, we've seen a little bit more frequency in that. And there's a little bit of a difference in, I guess, how they project that.
Yeah, I was going to ask, too, are meteorologists starting to reconsider the way that they're measuring this if we're having 100-year flooding events, you know, every couple of years now?
Okay, well, so WisContext did a great story about the 100-year flood concept. So I would recommend people go to wiscontext.org and check that out. But the way the probability of a flood is described right now is a 1% chance of a flood happening in any given year, or what's known as the 100-year flood. But that's all based on data about what's happened in an area in the past. And there are some problems with that because some areas have more complete data sets than others. And sometimes it goes back to the 1800s, but in other places you're working on about 50 years of rainfall records. But they're probabilities, you know, projections, predictions. That doesn't mean it's an absolute science. It's a baseline, not an end-all. So we know we're seeing it, and I think there's going to be it's a little unclear how that could be calculated in the future. With scientists and businesses and local governments, they would all have to sort out which projections to use and how to use them.
And I would imagine that going forward, you know, city officials, town officials, county officials are going to be thinking about this as they're planning, as they're looking at investments. What are you hearing, if anything, from these people at this point about what this means for, I don't know, future economic development in the area?
Yeah, I'm not sure about economic development, but I do know that the Wisconsin Wetlands Association just released a new study, and they're saying that, you know, maybe northern Wisconsin is more prone to flood damage right now because of the way their wetlands are right now. They're seeing stream beds that are carved deeper, and they're getting disconnected to wetland systems, and so that water that would normally spread out across the landscape is rushing downstream faster. And that, so basically you're seeing more flood peaks with that. And so they're making the case that maybe we can go upstream, make some changes to stream beds, stabilize them, and perhaps that could reduce flood risks in the future.
And as we begin to wrap up, will there be more prevention efforts or initiatives going forward?
Well, it sounds like the Wetlands Association would like to see that, and I'm sure that many people in northern Wisconsin would like to find a way to prevent this kind of damage. I mean, when you're talking about millions of dollars, you know, the average annual budget for a city like Ashland is $10 to $12 million a year. And you talk about, 2016, when we saw $35 million in damage across several counties. It's a lot of money that a lot of these towns and counties don't have.
Well, Danny, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
Danielle Kading is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Superior. She joined us today to give an update on flooding recovery efforts in northern Wisconsin. Being funny seems like a trait you're either born with or without. But many comedians and funny people agree that being funny requires more patience than you might imagine, and a lot of failure along the way can actually be a good thing.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you consider yourself to be funny? Did you grow up in a family that was always making jokes? How did you learn to be funny? Give us a call at 800-642-1234.
Brendan Leonard is an author, adventure writer, illustrator, and humorist. He writes about climbing, outdoor stuff, and other life musings, including what it takes to be funny, at his humor blog called Semi-Rad. Brendan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. So you've got a lot of creative projects going for you. We mentioned some of them there. You do a lot of writing about the outdoors. You write for your humor blog, a lot of funny illustrations for Instagram. The thread of humor seems to be what runs through all of these. When did you first realize, though, that you wanted to be funny?
Gosh, I think it was hanging out with my mom's family when I was a young kid, probably 7 or 8 years old, when I realized they had these, when the family got together, everyone was constantly joking, and it was, kind of a one-upmanship as well. With she has four sisters and two brothers, and I just remember thinking as a young kid, someday I'm going to make my Uncle Steve or my Uncle Dan laugh. And it took years because you're not very funny when you're 8 years old. You're especially not funny to adults, I guess, at that point.
And I'm also wondering, too, so I have a specific memory, because I grew up in a family where we made a lot of jokes, we were always pretty funny, and I remember going over to the family of my first serious girlfriend for a long time, and it was the exact opposite, and I was freaked out. Did this happen to you, too, like going to a different family and seeing how the other people did it?
That exactly happened. That's funny you should mention that, because it was, it was just many girlfriends. I just realized, I thought they didn't like me, and... because that's your immediate reaction. Like, oh, they just don't like me at all. But no, it's just people don't sit around and try to make each other laugh all the time. So my family was, it was a shock for sure, going to a different family and realizing there wasn't just laughs constantly. So
Brendan, you talked about your mother's family, but your dad also was a joker, not necessarily for his own good, but because he really wanted to make other people laugh. Tell us about the joy that you get from making someone laugh.
I think it comes from a very deep-seated insecurity. Stop laughing. I'm really serious.
No. Sorry.
I'll do public speaking engagements, and if the crowd isn't laughing, I think I'm doing a terrible job, which is not the case often. They're just listening, but I have to keep checking and cracking a joke every minute or every 30 seconds just to make sure, like, are you still with me? Mm-hmm. And I heard Mark Maron did an interview with Robin Williams several years ago, and they kind of were saying that their approach was, in talking to an audience, they were asking, do you love me? And if the audience laughed, they were loved. And then 5 minutes later, do you still love me? Mm-hmm. So I think maybe that's at the heart of it. Plus also we need to be having a good time here. So if we're laughing, to me, we're having a good time, I guess.
I have to say, with public speaking, when our nephews were in maybe middle school, one of them was practicing a speech he was giving about the Vikings, and he was practicing it in front of us, and my husband told him, always start with a joke, and we found out later that he actually did figure out a Viking joke to start his presentation with, and it went over really well. So there is something about trying to establish that connection with people right from the get-go.
Perfect. Yeah, for sure. And, I think we have enough earnest stuff in the world that it helps to have a little levity at sometimes, well, let's not take this so seriously. None of us are getting out of here alive,
We're talking right now with Brendan Leonard. He's an author, adventure writer, and illustrator, and he recently wrote a blog post called Learning to Be Funny. And Brendan, I want to pick up on that thread. How does somebody learn to be funny, and how do we get better at being funny?
Boy, I think trying and being unafraid of rejection are the two biggest things. You can't, you're never going to be funny if you're just sitting there listening the entire time. You have to interject at some point. And, you know, if you tell a joke and it doesn't land, it's not the end of the world. You know, I think being a writer, you get rejected by publishers and magazines all the time. And I hadn't realized this until a few weeks ago that I was prepared for rejection in the writing world because my jokes have been getting rejected my entire life, you know, since elementary school, when you yell something out from the back of the class and no one laughs and you get sent to the principal's office. That's not a good, you know, not a good outcome. So yeah, I think, you know, starting with other people's jokes is a great way to start, you know, jokes that you hear, that aren't necessarily things that you've created, but maybe things you found on the internet or, you know, someone told you knock, knock jokes are great. You know, kids jokes are great. And then you kind of learn timing from that and learn what is funny. And then just watching people who are funny and deconstructing, like, why did I laugh at that? You know, why is that clever?
I actually wanted to ask you that, like, what are some of the themes or components, or maybe it's the timing of jokes that you've realized over time, like, that is joke gold?
Oh man, dating is huge.
It's so, you know, relatable, isn't it?
Yeah, love and marriage are things that, you know, cohabitation. You know, I try to draw 3 or 4 charts a week on Instagram, and I feel like I have a good. I've been, you know, trying to observe my own behavior, and if I think this, somebody else must think it too. And the most successful ones to me are the things that land almost universally. You know. Things about, like, you know, this is what it's like when you're first in a relationship, but now it's turned into this. And I've always found it more effective to make fun of us instead of making fun of those people. So put yourself in that sort of, in the group you're making fun of. Otherwise you have this possibility where people are going to, you know, be offended. And if you're in it, you're making fun of yourself too. So people can't get that offended at it, I guess, is my take.
And Brendan, I was scrolling through your Instagram a little bit before this interview, and a lot of relatable stuff. And I pulled up this one. It's a picture of a book, and above the book it says "Story of My Life, Part 27." And then the title of the book is "I Was Going to Wait Till This Food Cooled Down So I Wouldn't Burn My Mouth, But Then I Didn't" by me. And I laughed out loud because that's like me all the time after making the super exciting thing in the kitchen. Can't wait to dig into it. And then what you were saying about relatability is great. But then I also thought, hey, this is funny, and it's not. Like, it's not rude, it's not in your face, it's just, you know, there, and it's something that we can all relate to. So I guess that what I'm seeing here is that, you know, comedy doesn't necessarily have to be like raunchy or dirty all the time to be funny.
No, but it can.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, things like that's a really easy illustration to pull off. There's a million of those, and I have a whole series in my head that, you know, would work, but I feel lazy because all I do is erase the cover of the book and put up another one, you know. And, but yeah, there's these things that you just think everybody goes through, probably, you know, regardless of political leaning, regardless of, you know, religion, regardless, you know, all these things that we do on a daily basis. And that's a really good place to start with humor. It's just kind of, did you ever notice that blank, you know? And of mm-hmm. course, yeah, I did. Wow, I do that too. And it's so funny that we both burned our mouth on pizza last week, and we keep doing it. Like, I'm 40 and I still can't eat pizza, apparently, you know?
There is something about that self-deprecating type of humor that I think, you know, it's a little vulnerability involved, but it also makes us more human.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's actually less vulnerable because you're taking a shot at yourself before anybody else can, you know.
That's like, a good point. Beat them to the punch, literally.
I already did that. I already did that bit. So you're not going to beat me to it. But thanks. Yeah.
So what's the difference between being funny, say, in conversation versus a standalone joke where you're waiting for the rim shot? Is one or the other easier to develop as a skill, as a talent?
Yeah. I mean, well, to me, you can memorize jokes, which is fantastic. You know, I have a whole set of guy walks into a bar jokes from when I used to be a bartender, which is almost 20 years ago. But the wisecrack, I think, is just like a skill you develop over time. And, you know, you try to throw it out there as much as you can without really interrupting the flow of conversation. But I think maybe I'm a bad listener because I'm always thinking about the next thing that could be funny sometimes, but I'm trying to be a better listener. But yeah, I think either one is a skill you develop. And, you kind of learn to read people and, you know, read rooms and if it's going to be in good taste or if it might land or if not, are you comfortable with the fallout, you know, and what's in good taste, you know, too. So, yeah, I don't know. I think recognizing a universally good joke that someone else has written is pretty easy. And I've told the same joke about polar bears to, you know, tons of different people. I didn't make it up, but I told it twice on a trip with a bunch of raft guides a couple weeks ago. And within seconds, you know, one guy thought it was the greatest. And he said, tell these guys that joke. And they all groaned. And I was like, oh, hey, all right, guys, sure.
Well, you know, you have to tell it now, Brendan.
Okay. It's, yeah. a polar bear walks into a bar, goes up to the bartender and says, I'll have a gin and tonic. And the bartender says, what's with the big paws? And the polar bear says, I don't know. My dad had them too.
That's a keeper.
Yeah. And age appropriate, you know, I mean, for all ages, you know, so I love it. It's one of my favorite jokes ever.
I'm wondering too, are there certain kind of jokes that you'd like to see make a comeback? I had a conversation with a coworker a while back and she mentioned that like no one tells your mom jokes anymore. And I can kind of see why, but are there certain jokes that we just don't tell anymore that you kind of wish we were still doing?
Oh man. I used to love mama jokes cause they actually became a big part of, hip hop albums in the 80s and 90s, people would put them on as skits. But in going back and listening to some of those albums, I realized why people don't do them anymore. yeah, they kind of don't stay. But yeah, I mean, I think humor, like any other media, is always evolving. And you could say things 50 years ago in the United States that right now that would not elicit a laugh. People would be offended. And I think that's a good thing. You know, it's progress as far as our society goes. And you could choose to complain about it and say, oh, there's nothing, you know, you can't even say a joke about this or that anymore, you know, because mm-hmm. everybody's going to get offended. And I think it just makes you it just makes you work harder for things that aren't going to be seen as offensive. And I think that's good that we're missing out on a lot of that old humor that has become distasteful and offensive.
Well, Brendan, thank you so much for joining us today. Brendan Leonard is an author, adventure writer, and illustrator. His recent blog post is Learning to Be Funny at semi-rad.com.
First, in response to President Trump's tough immigration policies, Democrats, protesters, and even some federal agents are calling for an end to the government agency known as ICE. That stands for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which falls under the Department of Homeland Security.
Among those who want to see ICE abolished is Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan. He told Fox News last week that the agency has lost its way under the Trump administration.
What you're supposed to do is go after people who pose a real threat. It was created after 9/11 with the main focus being around people who might have terrorist activity. Now we're going after people with a traffic violation at a church or at a workplace. That doesn't make any sense.
Pocan has introduced a bill that would dismantle ICE. It would also set up a committee to advise Congress on how to implement a, quote, humane immigration enforcement system.
But what exactly is ICE? What does it do? What doesn't it do? And what about this push to do away with it?
Ron Nixon is the Homeland Security correspondent for The New York Times. He covers border and aviation security, immigration, transnational crime, and other security issues. Ron, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get to the calls to get rid of ICE, can you give us a brief history lesson on the agency? What was its purpose when it was created in 2003?
Right. So ICE is a combination of two agencies that no longer exist, the U.S. Customs Service and Immigration and Naturalization Service. The two agencies, one, the Customs Service fell under the Treasury Department. They did smuggling, long-term investigations. If the listeners saw the movie The Infiltrator, that was the Customs Service. The INS, which is under the Justice Department, did a number of things, including rounding up people who were in the country illegally, detaining them, and deporting them. Very different missions, but the two pieces were put together under the agency that we now call ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
So ICE itself is made up of three different offices, the most well-known being Enforcement and Removal Operations. What happens there?
Enforcement and Removal Operations is the part of ICE that, as you noted, that is most known to the general public. It is the agency, the division, rather, that goes and looks for, you know, those folks who are in the country illegally, detains them, and then begins the process of deporting them. There have been various ways that they've done that over time. In the previous administration, the priority was on deporting people who had, you know, criminal records, not so much just generally going after people for, as the congressman said, who, you know, maybe had a speeding ticket or something else that was a minor offense. And under the Trump administration, it changed that priority and said that, you know, everyone who's in the country illegally is now fair game.
We'll go back to enforcement and removal in a moment, but I want to quickly talk about the other two offices so we get an idea of the scope of ICE as a whole. Can you tell us about Homeland Security Investigations?
Well, Homeland Security Investigations has about 8,000 people in it, and they do long, deep transnational investigations into things like drug smuggling and cybercrime and child pornography. It's similar to what you would see from the FBI or from ATF or from DEA. But traditionally, what the U.S. Customs Office had done over you know, its life cycle. And so HSI is about 6,000 special agents who they go undercover. They do, you know, the same thing that special agents at, like, at an agency like the FBI with different authorities, but just think of it in terms of that kind of thing. And because of the FBI sort of shifting its focus after 9/11 to deal more with counterterrorism, a lot of the taking on organized crime has been taken on by Homeland Security Investigations.
And then the smallest ICE office is the Office of the Principal Legal Advisor. Can you briefly tell us what their scope is?
Right. So these are the lawyers at ICE, and they both serve the side that does the detentions and deportation. They also provide legal advice for Homeland Security Investigations. They also represent the Department of Homeland Security in immigration court. So essentially, they are the attorneys for the agency.
We're talking with Ron Nixon. He's the Homeland Security correspondent for the New York Times. He covers border security and other security issues, and we're talking about ICE, what it does, what it doesn't, and calls for its abolition. And one of the things that I think has been a big misunderstanding in this current debate about immigration, especially separation at the border, is a lot of people think that it's ICE that's separating those families, but that's not correct, right, Ron?
That's correct that it's incorrect. There are the agency that is doing that is also within the Department of Homeland Security, but that is Customs and Border Protection, which is the parent agency of the Border Patrol, among other things. So two different agencies, two different missions, but there has been a lot of conflating Customs and Border Protection, CBP, with ICE. I was somewhere... escapes me at the moment. I've been traveling a lot. But there were people who were, you know, protesting and saying abolish ICE, but they were actually at a Customs and Border Protection facility.
Well, and even more confusing might be that just recently a high-ranking official with the Border Patrol was named by President Trump to be the acting director of ICE after the director before him retired. Can you tell us a little bit about that new head of ICE?
Yes, this is the new acting director of ICE is Ron Vitello's, you know, longtime Border Patrol agent. He was the assistant deputy commissioner at the Customs and Border Protection, who, again, he has been with the Border Patrol for years. Brings, a different posture to the agency than the previous director who sort of took a very hard-line stance and echoed a lot of the rhetoric from the president. Mr. Vitello is a little bit more politically savvy than that, so I don't think you'll hear the same kind of rhetoric that you heard from the previous director there.
Well, and if either Mr. Vitello or another person would be nominated to be the new full-time director, that person would need to be approved by the Senate. Given so much attention being focused on ICE lately, especially with these calls to abolish the agency that we'll get into more, what might that confirmation process look like?
I think it'll be a tough confirmation process. I think it's one of the reasons that it never went that far with Mr. Holman. He was nominated, but they never really pushed his confirmation to the Senate. I think even though Mr. Vitello, again, brings a different posture, a different attitude to the agency, I think it would be a very tough confirmation given the climate and given the rhetoric around abolishing ICE.
So we did hear from Congressman Mark Pocan of Wisconsin at the top of this segment saying that ICE ought to worry more about potential terrorists than raiding churches for traffic violators. Are other Democrats also saying the same thing, or do they have other reasons for saying that ICE should be abolished or at the very least seriously restructured?
I think that's sort of generally what you hear, that it has gotten away from it. From its mission, but I would disagree that it has gotten away from its mission, because that's really, there are two missions within ICE, and so to say that it has gotten away from its mission, I think doesn't really get to the fact that the part of ICE that's now called ERO, or Enforcement Removal Operations, that's always been its job. That has not changed. It's been a question of priorities, like who do they prioritize? Do they prioritize, the grandma who has too much tint on her window and gets pulled over by the cops, or do they prioritize, the gang member or the drug cartel, the smugglers? But that has nothing to do with Homeland Security investigations. They are still doing those things, like going after, threats to national security. They're still going after drug traffickers. They're still going after child pornographers. So that ICE hasn't gotten away from that mission. It's just that the two sides of it do very different things.
It's been reported that there are, in fact, ICE agents who are also advocating for getting rid of the agency. What is their position?
So this is long running. This is not something that just happened a few weeks ago. When the agency was created, the people who are from the Customs Service, they didn't like the fact that they were being subsumed by this agency that had immigration in its title, because that's not what they did. Again, these were guys who took on big drug cases and gun runners and infiltrated drug cartels. That's what they did. And so they felt like the mission was kind of muddled, which in some ways it is, because people don't really understand what ICE actually does. And so their thing is that it should be split into two. So the Enforcement Removal Operations should be its own agency, and Homeland Security Investigations should be its own agency, and they should not be under the same umbrella as ICE, because they have very distinct missions.
We're talking about the push to abolish the agency known as ICE, or the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Ron Nixon is the Homeland Security correspondent for the New York Times. He's helping us understand the calls by Democrats, protesters, and even some federal agents to dismantle the agency.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see ICE be scrapped? If so, what should replace it? Or should this agency be supported? Maybe you think it shouldn't be abolished, but it needs some serious changes. If so, what does that look like to you? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
We're continuing our discussion with New York Times Homeland Security correspondent Ron Nixon on ICE, shorthand for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and the future of the agency.
What do you think? Is it time to abolish ICE? Has the agency lost its way? If ICE is gone, what should be put in its place? Or do you support the tougher enforcement measures it's taking? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Ron, you know, there are these calls to abolish ICE. Are those opponents of the agency as it stands now proposing something in its place?
I think that there's been a number of things that have been thrown out. One is that you would take the parts of it and put it within the Justice Department, which, again, that's where it was before, under INS, Immigration and Naturalization Service, which was, at the Justice Department. And it would also be under the watchful eye of the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, who is the architect of a lot of the Trump administration's immigration policies. So that would seem to defeat the purpose of why they try to reform the agency or put it somewhere else where it would be better run. There are a number of things out there. Some people are saying it should just be gotten rid of altogether. Others are saying, well, it just needs to be reformed. There's no one particular thing on what should be done with the agency, but I would just add that there has always been some type of agency that has done detentions and deportations, and it's not new. I think this what's new here is the size of ICE and its detention and deportation. Us now that is far larger than what you had under the Immigration and Naturalization Service.
Let's go to the phones, and Yordis is in Colfax. Hi, Yordis.
Hi. I just think that this can be a distraction to abolish ICE and have that a message. I think the message has to be continually put on Trump and his policies, which are they're asking ICE and the people in those agencies to do cruel, immoral, and un-American things to psychologically terrorize people that are just trying to migrate in this country, either to get asylum or to come in illegally. This is a sick way to discourage migration, and it was a policy thought up by Stephen Miller and the Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
And thanks for that call, Yordis. And Ron, Yordis is laying this squarely at the feet of President Trump. And, I don't think he would actually take offense to that. In a speech at the Salute to Service dinner in West Virginia Tuesday, he called ICE agents tough cookies who are liberating towns from the gangs, including MS-13. And he said ICE isn't going anywhere.
Then I hear Democrats saying, we want to abandon ICE. We want to abandon. We're not abandoning ICE, and we're not abandoning our law enforcement. Just the opposite.
And there is support for that position. Rick on Facebook wrote, ICE are the bravest people in America right now. Scott on Facebook also commented, ICE should be expanded in every state and doubled on our borders. How much support would you say there is out there for ICE as it is and what they're doing today?
I haven't really seen any numbers that show what the support is for or against ICE. I do know that those sentiments do cut both ways. There are people who support the agency, and there are people who say that it has gone too far and it needs to be disbanded. I think that one of the things that's sort of lost in all of this is that it would take an act of Congress to do anything, whether it's reform or even to abolish the agency. And with Republicans being in control of the Congress right now, that hardly seems likely.
I want to go back to the congressional issue in a moment, but let's go back to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Don in Jackson is up. Hi, Don.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a conservative, and my wife and her immediate family immigrated to America legally in 1969. And so what I don't understand about this whole issue is that ICE is simply enforcing existing law. That's it. They're not making it up as they go. They're just enforcing existing law. And that we are a law, a land of law, and we need to follow the law. Now, if you don't like the law, fine. Lobby your congressman, get the law changed. I have no problem with that. But the point is that ICE should not be dismantled because they are simply enforcing the law. The past president said you can ignore this part of the law. Our president now says, yes, it's the law. We're going to enforce it. I don't see the issue.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Don. And Don saying, you know, this is the law and it's just making sure it gets followed.
Well, it is the law. I think the question is, how is the law followed? And under the Obama administration, they didn't ignore the law. They simply created a list of priorities, given the fact that there's limited budget and limited personnel to be able to deport, you know, an estimated 11 million people that are in the country who are undocumented. ICE simply does not have the personnel to be able to do that. So they created this priorities list to say, okay, well, these are the people that we are going to make our priority for deportation. Again, these were people who had extensive criminal records, gang members, drug dealers, and those kinds of folks. So it didn't ignore the law, it simply created priorities for who would be subject to deportation given the available resources.
We have some big midterm elections coming up in November, and Ron, obviously ICE and issues of immigration, the issue of family separation at the border, even though, as we have said, that is not actually ICE doing that. But these are huge hot button topics. A lot of members of Congress being up for reelection or challenging to get into Congress. How do you see these issues playing as candidates and sitting members of Congress try to appeal to their bases?
I think this is definitely going to be an issue in the midterms for both Republicans and Democrats. I think for Democrats that are in so-called red states, that they won't be inclined to push forward on this abolish ICE. I think they'll take a more nuanced stance and say, hey, it needs to be reformed, but not abolished because you will always need something like that. I think Democrats that are in other areas, areas that are that tend to lean more liberal, it could be a winning issue. It remains to be seen, but I think for a lot of Republicans, they will definitely support the agency because you seen the GOP saying, hey, you have open borders. Again, as we've said, that's not what ICE does, but I think you'll hear that argument made that, well, if you don't support ICE, then you support open borders and criminals and gangs like MS-13, as the president mentioned in his speech.
Well, Ron, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Ron Nixon is the Homeland Security correspondent for the New York Times. We talked with him about what Immigration and Customs Enforcement does and why some Democrats want the agency abolished. And you can keep the conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A few people have already weighed in on whether they think I should stay or go. You can add your opinion as well. Again, that's the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, there was a time when the 4th of July was a holiday celebrated mostly by African Americans. We'll learn about that hidden history.
On Food Friday, we'll get some fresh takes on summer staples like burgers, pies, and lemonade.
And we'll look at the history of refrigeration. We tend to take it for granted now, but it's had a huge influence on human history and human culture.
All that and more coming up tomorrow at this time on Central Time.